This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, Dr. Joe Pagan begins a three-part series on the evolution of sport horse feeding, and Sarah Geike has our trainer's tip of the week. But before we hear from Sarah, the USDF has announced this week its dates and locations for the 2015 Great American Insurance Group USDF Regional Dressage Championships, presented by SmartPak and supported by Merriall. Competitors qualify for the Great American USDF Regional Championships by competing in designated qualifying classes throughout the year at USDF-recognized competitions. You can find more information on the Regional Championships by following the link on the front page of the website at usdf.org. Sarah Geike has our trainer's tip this week, and she's going to focus on some advice for riding corners.
That is my topic for today, is riding corners. And I know it sounds like it's a pretty boring one, but it actually can become very exciting the more you learn about it. So what I have found from judging throughout the country and all these various places, myself and my colleagues, we often see poorly ridden corners. And I'd first like to say that a corner that is ridden and trained well is a tremendous hallmark of correct riding. As judges, unfortunately, what we often see are corners that are not understood and not ridden well. So consequently, the horse ends up going through the corner either by what I call motorcycling through it, where they fall in tremendously, losing their balance over the inner shoulder. Or the other common thing we see is the opposite, where the horse completely falls through the outside aids, not bending, but really just falling through the corner. So the end result of both of these scenarios is the horse is out of balance, as in most cases is the rider as a result of the horse's issues. And then they both start down the long side of the arena, most likely crooked, often hollow, and lacking the proper balance that they need. Whether we're looking at riding a test in a horse show or we're looking at training at home, if you think about it, we're schooling in a rectangular area, so there is always going to be a corner preceding an exercise or a movement. Always. So with that in mind, it makes sense to really break down and think about how we as riders and trainers can improve the use of corners in our corner training to not only improve our test scores, but to most importantly, to improve our horse's overall athletic ability and balance. So really what I see as the benefits of riding a correct corner are simply, now, as I just stated, that number one, we tend to improve the overall balance of the horse because the corners, when they're ridden well, they can set the horse up very nicely for the next movement or exercise. The corners also help to prepare the horse for the next exercise. And lastly, the corners really help to improve the overall suppleness, lateral suppleness of the horse, and it also has a nice improvement in the horse's longitudinal suppleness. So those are the real benefits. When we look at a horse and rider at any level, training level through Grand Prix, when we look at a corner that's ridden correctly, it gives us the visual impression that, number one, it's balanced. And when I say that, I mean that the horse is between the rider's outside aids and inside aids, so that the rider has control over the line of travel, right, and the degree of bend. All right. The second thing we should see when we ride a corner is simply that the horse is bent around the rider's inner leg and seat bone. And the illusion of, or rather the element of bending that we want to see is that from his ears to his whole body to his tail, his body forms a uniform curved line so that the shoulders and hips are on that line, the inner hind leg lands under the center of gravity. The horse shouldn't speed up or slow down or get longer in his frame or stride or shorter in his frame or stride. He should simply maintain the same consistency in the balance, rhythm, and tempo. And the last thing about a well-ridden corner that you can see is that it has a clear beginning and it has a clear ending. Now, in a dressage arena, the beginning point is, of course, the quarter marker, you know, H or M or F or K. But then, and when you're finished the corner, there is also an imaginary ending to the quarter marker. So those are the things that we kind of look for in riding a corner in general, whether, again, whether it's in a test at a horse show or homeschooling, just trying to improve our horses. One of my favorite sayings at home with my students is that geometry is important. Geometry is the prerequisite for riding and improving the horse's suppleness. And this very much holds true for corner training and corner riding. So when we think about corners, and then we think about riding our horse, and we look at the development of a young horse, corners are one of the very first things that we have to figure out how to negotiate with a young horse in his first learning steps. So it's really the first opportunity that we have to bend the horse. A general rule of thumb when you ride corners is that you only go as deeply into the corner as the size circle that you are schooling with that horse. For example, at training level, we have 20-meter circles. We would expect to see a training level horse go through the corner as if it was on a comparable arc of a 20-meter circle. That way the horse has the best possibility to bend and to keep his balance and to develop. Likewise, for a Grand Prix horse, we would expect that Grand Prix horse to go in the corner since if it was part of a 6-meter volte, so very much deeper. Okay, so I would just like to very briefly mention our bending aids, because I see a lot of problems that riders have with their actual aids to bend the horse. And this is, of course, really important because it allows us to develop success. So I'd like to touch on this for a moment. In our bending aids that we use, we call it the bending seat. And what I'm sure everyone is familiar with it, and it involves the use of both legs, both seat bones, both reins. But we specifically have to make sure that our inner leg is at the girth. It is the active leg together with the inner seat bone, which is weighted and slightly more forward than the outside. This is our active bending aid. Our outside passive leg is behind the girth, preventing the haunches from swinging out. The rider's shoulders follow the horse's shoulders. The inside rein of the rider encourages flexion through the pole and jaw. The outside rein of the rider acts as a direct rein to prevent the neck from overbending and to help control the outside shoulder of the horse. So we're using all our aids in this bending seat to encourage a uniform bend in the whole of the horse's body. Difficulty in riding corners comes from the rider being able to successfully identify and address the horse's stiff and hollow sides. We know that horses all have that. They're asymmetrical, just like people. And what often happens is on the hollow, more concave side, the neck of the horse tends to overbend, which makes the horse fall more through the outside shoulder. So on the concave side or the hollow side, we often find horses tend to go too deep in the corner and get stuck and lose their balance. And then on the stiffer side, the convex side, a horse has more difficulty really coming through the inside rib cage. He has a natural propensity to want to balance a little more on that inner shoulder. So when a rider is making a corner on the stiff side, oftentimes what happens is the horse ends up in that motorcycle position, falling in and leaning inward. So this is a very important consideration that in terms of the rider's aids, that the rider does not let himself get overwhelmed by the horse's stiff and hollow side. And by that I mean what often happens is when the horse is struggling, to engage the inside hind leg and bend, the rider often gets thrown to the outside. So it's important the rider can stay stable into the center of the saddle. So I have, I'd like to just talk about four exercises that I have that I'm hoping will encourage and help all of the listeners to be able to improve the use of their corners. And again, this is going to be valuable for horses at intro level all the way up to FEI level. And they're very simple exercises. They're very simple. I'll start with the first one. It involves simply riding around in a quality working trot where the horse is accepting contact. He's balanced. You're going to ride around the full arena in trot. When you get to the quarter marker, for example, at H, you're going to ride half halt in the transition to the walk. And then you're going to walk through the corner on your appropriate arc of corner for your horse's training. Immediately when you get to the other side of the corner, you're going to make a crisp trot transition. And then you're going to trot to the next corner, and you're going to do exactly the same thing so that you make your transition at the prescribed place. And it's important that you can be really accurate because it's the accuracy that helps to train the horse. So you walk before the next corner, walk through the corner, and then at M immediately transition to trot down the long side, and then you do the exact same thing at the next corners. So you might find that you will ride this exercise two, three, maybe four times going around the arena, making these transitions in this manner. What you're looking for is that the horse starts to catch on of what the exercise involves, and he starts to anticipate a little bit, and that will be a good thing. When you get to that point, then you're going to replace the full transition from trot to walk with just a half halt, two half halts, and then you're going to stay in the trot. So by doing this, you're training the horse to accept and listen to your half halt before and after each corner. And we're also training the rider to do the same thing. So that the end result is you're saying to the horse, listen, wait for me, give me a chance to bend you with my aid through the corner. And this, it's simple, but it works beautifully. You can do this in the canter, where you can make ride a working canter around the arena, and then you can either do a transition to trot or a transition to walk, depending upon your horse's level. And then, of course, you want to do it in the other direction and have the same comparable results. Okay, that's our first exercise. Our second exercise is, again, it's a very simple one and can be done in walk, trot, canter. You need to be very precise with how deep or how shallow you go in your corner. And what you're going to do is count the strides of your horse in the walk first, trot first, and canter first through each corner. As you're probably guessing, your goal is to be able to have the exact same number of strides in each corner, all right, within each gate and within each direction. It's going to be challenging to do it and to have it equally in both directions. But again, this helps to give you more, to develop more of a feel for consistency in your horse's bend and consistency in his strides and his balance. Beautiful exercise, but very simple. Okay, third exercise, again, pretty straightforward, involves, it's probably going to involve a helper, where you need to, you're going to have the use of cones in your corners, and you need to first determine for the particular horse you're riding and training what is the exact corner line that you need to be riding with that horse. So you need to map it out a little bit ahead of time. Then you're going to take your cone and you're going to put it to the inside of the corner so that when you ride your corner, you will ride to the outside of the cone on a proper line of travel through your corner. And this is just a visual parameter and guide for you and your horse to show you where you need to be. Combining the use of cones with the first two exercises that we said, counting strides and the transitions and half halts before and after the corner, can really give you tremendous results. Okay, last exercise that I have for today, again, can be applied to horses at all levels, training through FEI. This is what you're going to do. And this particular exercise is really helpful to develop a better feel for the rider, for the outside aids, and also to help educate the horse more clearly about the job of the outside aids, which is to keep the horse straight and to keep the outside hind leg engaged and under control. All right, so in this exercise, you're going to ride medium walk. Okay, in this particular exercise, even at lower level horses, you're going to go a little more deeply into the corners than you would normally do if you were bending. And the exercise involves riding a quarter turn on the haunches when you're at the point of the corner, so that it's going to feel to you as if you're actually making a square corner for this particular exercise. But the purpose is to, again, get the horse thinking about accepting in a supple way the outside aid, so the rider can use the outside aid to straighten, organize the horse, and that gives you something to bend the horse into. You can ride it with a lower level horse just in medium walk. All right, you can get a little more creative with a horse that has more education, where you could canter or trot and get to the quarter marker and then make a transition to walk and then walk to the corner doing a quarter turn, and then as you come out of the corner, canter or trot. Mixing it up and blending these different exercises only helps to improve your horse's suppleness and athleticism. So those are just some ideas for that I hope will help all of the listeners to improve your horses and to improve your test riding ability. Riding accurate tests and riding supple corners, rather, is something that is within the reach of every single horse and rider. With a little knowledge and with some steps to show you how to get there, everybody can be successful.
Well, some wonderful information there. Lots to think about, Sarah. Thank you very much indeed for presenting our trainer's tip this week.
Okay, thank you so much, Chris. As always, it's a pleasure talking with you.
Dr. Joe Pagan is the president and founder of Kentucky Equine Research, and in this segment, he begins a three-part series on the evolution of sport horse feeding. This series is taken from an education session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention.
The title of this talk is Evolution of Performance Horse Feeding, and that's actually a pretty broad topic because there's a lot of different types of performance horses. Ones that go relatively slow for a long way, like endurance horses, some that go really fast for a short distance, like race horses, and then everything in between. All of these horses have one thing in common, though. Really what they're doing is they're moving. So when we're feeding these horses, it's different than when we're feeding other types of livestock. We're not trying to produce meat or milk or eggs. We're producing locomotion. And so we really have to look at feeding the performance horse in a completely different light than we do in feeding other types of horses or other types of livestock. And because locomotion is really what we're doing, we're fueling muscle contraction. And it takes energy to fuel muscle contraction. So energy is the nutritional factor that's most influenced by work. And it's the one where the greatest change has occurred in terms of how we feed horses today. The horse's muscle is very versatile. It can make the energy that's needed to fuel muscle contraction from a lot of different metabolic pathways. It's not that important that you know what those are, only that the horse has several different fuels that it can convert into the end product, the actual molecule that's used to fuel muscle contraction. A couple of the main fuels are sugars. They're blood glucose and muscle glycogen. And the other big one is fat. So those are the three different fuels that horses can potentially use to fuel muscle contraction. We can't feed glucose to a horse, but we can feed other carbohydrates. And in fact, there's four basic groups that we can feed to a horse to supply the energy that they can use to convert to fuel muscle contraction. We can feed them plant fiber. We can feed them non-structural carbohydrates, or NSC. That's a big buzzword now. You're going to hear that a lot about performance feeds these days. NSC is really a combination of two different types of sugars, starch and sugar. Starch is essentially sugar. It's a bunch of glucose molecules that are hooked together. Then there's simple sugars like glucose and fructose and sucrose as well. There's fat and there's protein. This is the choice that we have in terms of fuels that we can actually provide the horse. Well, in nature, the horse evolved to eat nothing but forage. They were wandering herbivores. They have a really specialized digestive tract to handle plant fiber. And if you look at the horse's digestive tract, the horse has a small, simple stomach, a narrow, small intestine, and then they've got this huge hind gut. This is the cecum and the colon. And it's about 70% of the total size of the horse's digestive tract. And the reason they have that is the hind gut is a big fermentation vat. It's where the horse houses billions of bacteria, beneficial bacteria that break down plant fiber. So a horse can survive on eating hay, on eating pasture, because these bacteria break this down. Now, the problem with that, though, is it's a fairly slow process. This fermentation of plant fiber produces very good energy for the horse, but it takes a while. When the horse isn't doing anything, when it's just wandering around grazing, that's plenty of energy for the horse. But as we domesticated the horse and started to ask it to work, the demand for energy became greater. And so with this demand for extra energy with domestication, we ended up meeting that deficit by feeding cereal grains. Cereal grains are high in starch, this chain of glucoses, and this is what was supplemented. And really, that's where horse nutrition was for a couple of thousand years. That's how you fed a horse. It was hay, oats, and water. You fed forage, a cereal grain, and that was about it. And things didn't really change very much for a long, long time. In fact, it didn't really change very much until the 1980s. And in the 1980s, we became interested in feeding fat to horses. And at first you would think, well, that's an odd thing to do because a horse isn't going to eat fat in nature. But it turns out that fat, actually, horses do quite well when you feed fat. Number one, fat is very energy dense. There's a lot of calories packed into it. 2.5 times as many calories as in corn, 3 times as many calories as in oats. And surprisingly, horses do a good job digesting fat. Horses don't have gallbladders like we have. They continuously secrete bile, but they can digest fat very well. And we started to measure some performance benefits of feeding fat. We started by substituting fat for part of the cereal grain, and we studied a lot of different types of fats. We studied vegetable oils, and even back then, Texas A&M did a lot of work feeding animal fat, and there were some quite good results from feeding fat. I first started working with feeding fat to horses in the mid-1980s when I was doing research at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. After I finished my PhD, I went over there because at the time it was the only place in the world that had a high-speed treadmill. And I studied feeding different energy sources to horses, and one of those energy sources was fat. Since that time, we've done a lot of work on feeding fat and have discovered that the horse can not only digest it well, but its muscles can use fat very well. And in fact, you can train a horse's muscle to use fat. This is a study that we did that we published in 2002, where we looked, and the horses that we were most interested in were endurance horses. We used Arabian horses, and we fed them either a high-fat diet or a high non-structural carbohydrate diet. Same number of calories, but from different types of energy. We fed this for 10 weeks, and at the beginning, the middle, and the end, we did standardized exercise tests with these horses to see how much fat they were actually burning. In the control, about half of those calories came from the non-structural carbohydrates I was talking about before, but only 7% came from fat. This would have been typical of a regular cereal grain-based type diet. We fed enough fat so that about 30% of the total calories came from fat, and when we did exercise tests with these horses, we measured that they were able to utilize that fat quite well. One of the things we do allows us to measure oxygen consumption and carbon dioxide production. The ratio of those two tell us whether the horse is burning carbohydrate or fat. We also take blood samples from the horse while they're exercising. And in this particular experiment, we used a stable isotope to see whether the horses were utilizing glucose, and if they were, if it was coming from their liver. And what we found was that when we fed this fat for 5 weeks, that we could get the horse to switch its metabolism pretty completely so that it depended on liver glucose production by an amount that was 30% less when we fed fat. So we were able to spare the utilization of carbohydrates by adding fat. And when we looked at the respiratory exchange ratio, is that ratio of oxygen and carbon dioxide I talked about, we were able to greatly change it from feeding fat. So yeah, horses can use fat. It's an alternative energy source. And really that became quite the change in terms of how we formulated feeds. At this point, we were using cereal grains with added fat. But we wanted to look at yet another type of energy substrate. For that, we switched to one of beet pulp. Beet pulp is a fibrous energy source, but it's a special kind of fiber. We consider beet pulp to be a super fiber. And the reason we call it that is because the bacteria in the horse's digestive tract can really ferment the fiber in beet pulp very well. Almost 100% of it they can utilize. Normally, the fiber that you would find in hay, a bacteria in the digestive tract, can only break down about half of that plant fiber. We made measurements with beet pulp where that digestibility was 75 to 80% digestible, which made beet pulp have the digestible energy content that was almost as high as oats. So now we had a source of energy that was more like what the horse would have used in nature, but it was in a much more compact, energy-dense form. So the evolution of performance horse feeds went from straight cereal grains to adding some fat to adding fermentable fiber sources. Beet pulp, almost all of the calories come from fermentation of fiber, corn and oats, quite a bit from non-structural carbohydrates. So with the combination of those, the feed of the 1990s became a mixture of energy sources. It had still predominantly most of the calories were coming from non-structural carbohydrates. That's from cereal grains, from molasses if you had a textured feed. But we started to get more energy from fiber, mainly by adding beet pulp. Today we use beet pulp and we use soy hulls. Soy hulls are the seed coat of the soybean. They have fiber very similar to beet pulp that's very fermentable. So these were added, and here was a nice mixture of energy sources, and that was sort of the state of the art in the 1990s. And this is what we fed performance horses, and it really didn't matter if it was a racehorse or a dressage horse or an eventer. This was sort of where we were at. About that time, we began collaborating with Dr. Stephanie Valberg. Stephanie is a veterinarian, a PhD, whose specialty is studying muscle disorders in horses. She's the leading expert in the world on various types of muscle disorders. And the one that she was particularly interested in was tying up. This is a big problem that occurs in a number of different types of performance horses. And tying up, or exertional rhabdomyolysis, is something that's seen very much in racehorses and in horses that that exercise very strenuously. There's another type of tying up, though, that occurs in quarter horses and warmbloods called polysaccharide storage myopathy. These diseases were diseases that we were interested in seeing if there was any sort of nutritional relationship. Polysaccharide storage myopathy, again, is a type of tying up. You see it in quarter horses, paints, appaloosas, and you see it in warm bloods as well. It comes from the cell having enhanced insulin sensitivity. In other words, the cell is oversensitive to insulin, so it can suck up a lot of glucose into the cell, but it stores it as an abnormal form of muscle glycogen. The other type of tying up, RER, is the one that we see in thoroughbred standardbreds and probably in Arabs. This is a stress-related disorder of calcium regulation in the muscle. Doesn't have anything to do with insulin sensitivity, and you don't have abnormal polysaccharide storage. But both of them seem to have a common thread, and that is that both of these seem to get worse when you fed diets that were high in non-structural carbohydrate, in regular feeds that were high in starch and sugar. RER, again, is, if you look at the epidemiology of RER, it has it's more common in females than males. So there's a gender predilection. It's about 5% of racing thoroughbreds are affected. And one thing that seems to be in common here is a nervous disposition. It increases with increased fitness, stress, and excitement. And typically in between these episodes of tying up, the level of muscle enzymes in the horse are normal. But this seems to be lack of daily exercise and high starch diets predispose these horses to tying up. We know that in RER, Stephanie discovered in R&R that there's a genetic basis, that there were specific horses that had a gene that made them more likely to tie up. And she's done breeding trials to confirm that. The disorder actually occurs equally in males and females. The gene that causes this problem with calcium regulation in the muscle is not sex linked, but it seems that the problem is triggered by stress and exercise, and there is a role of temperament, lameness, and diet. So we began working with Stephanie's group in the 1990s to see if diet actually had played a role in terms of the development of RER. To do this, we used a group of fillies that Stephanie had identified had the gene that predisposed them to tying up. We developed a diet at that point that was very, very low in non-structural carbohydrate. This was a type of feed that we had never done before. We made it so that only about 10% of the calories came from non-structural carbohydrate. If you remember the normal diets that we would have done, 50% came from non-structural carbohydrate. So this was a strange feed, really. We made it so about 30% of the calories came from fat and a large amount came from fiber. And we did that by using a lot of vegetable oil, a lot of beet pulp, and stabilized rice bran. That's what was used in terms of this special ration. We took this diet that was very low in non-structural carbohydrate and we compared it to a traditional type of sweet feed that was high in non-structural carbohydrates. We took the horses that were predisposed to tying up and performed a standardized exercise test at the University of Minnesota on their treadmill. And they had determined that this exercise test triggered tying up in these RER horses. And the way we measured whether the horses actually tied up or not is after they did the exercise test, 4 hours later, you take a blood sample and you look for an elevation in serum CPK. This is an enzyme that normally is inside the muscle. If a horse ties up, the muscle cell is disrupted. The CPK or CK leaks out into the blood and you see an elevation. So the first treatment that we did is we tested sweet feed, but we fed it at a pretty low level, only 21 megacalories, that for a horse that was in high intensity work, that horse would have lost weight. It wasn't enough to meet their energy requirement. But when we did the test, we found their CK wasn't very high. So they really weren't tying up when they were on a traditional type of sweet feed fed at a low level. When we increased the amount of that sweet feed, though, to a level that would maintain their body weight when they were in work, we got a big elevation in CPK. This is what people were demonstrating out in the real world, that when you fed a lot of grain to a horse that tied up, you got symptoms of tying up. So we wanted to replicate this with relieve the low starch, low NSC feed. First, we fed it at that low level of intake, and the horse didn't tie up. But they didn't tie up when we fed the sweet feed either. The real test would be, if we fed relieve at a high level of caloric intake, would the horses tie up? And when we did, they didn't tie up. So we were able to prevent these horses that had this genetic predisposition to tying up by feeding them this low starch, high fat, high fermentable fiber diet. But the question is, why did it work? What was it about that feed that actually caused them not to tie up? There wasn't any change in the level of muscle glycogen or lactic acid that the muscle produced. That's a bit of a wives' tale about tying up. It's not from lactic acid accumulation. It wasn't affected by calcium intake, and since it's a disorder of calcium regulation in the muscle, that was one of the questions. What we noticed, though, is when these horses were on the treadmill for this test, they were calmer. They had lower heart rates. And it seems that that led to this decrease in this stress-induced rhabdomyolysis. So the effect that we were having seemed to be on temperament and on behavior. But the question was, why is it that the fillies are the ones that are tying up? The gene that causes this is the same in males and females. Well, it may very well be that there's more than one gene involved, and it could be that there is another gene that's an anxiety gene. And they've shown that in humans, there are genes that are associated with anxiety. They affect neurotransmitters in the brain, and some are associated with glycolysis, which is the chemical pathway that by which sugar is metabolized. So it may very well be that the effect was being done on this anxiety gene. And it's interesting that in humans anyway, it seems to be more prevalent in women than in men, the anxiety gene. So it seems that really what we were doing is we were developing a feed to affect temperament. And that was a real sea change in terms of the way we formulated feeds, because that was never taken into consideration before. Before, it was what substrates were we going to use for fueling muscle contraction. So the question is, are there other types of equine behavior that are feed related?
And you can hear part two in this series by Dr. Pagan in next week's episode. This podcast is available for download on iTunes. Visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education, at usdf.org. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.